Berkeley, 88.1, KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So in moments, I will be introducing our longtime fabulous ally, Green Wizard David Bloom, but first a little bit of segueing from last week to this week. So last week, we were dedicated to Syria, as may it always remain in our hearts, with the great guest Deborah Felmuth, and she had sort of assured me that the temple that had been blown up was a beautiful, exquisite small temple in Palmyra, but not the big one that we knew. Well, this week, the big one that we knew, the Temple of Baal, was blown up by Daesh. Let us call it Daesh, not ISIS. It is Daesh. And this is poignant and symbolic in the mythic news. Just briefly, Palmyra, you know, was a first century AD, extraordinary city and place. and in the third century, it emerges as one of the great cities of the world under Queen Zenobia. It was she presided over Syria, what is now Syria and Palestine, and then the Romans inhale her back, no, and then a decline, and the monument's covered with sand and then excavated. But the Temple of Baal that was blown up this week is so poignant because when we were there and our wonderful guide said, this is how this temple keeps itself safe. Look, because all divine images are welcome. Every local deity, Baal was an incredibly tolerant god. He was like, everybody, sure, absolutely. Christianity, no problem. Everybody welcome. There we go. So it was presumed to be safe for 2,000 years because of its tolerance. Also the ingenuity of the technology. Our guide told us this is how it kept itself safe physically, because through the great structure were these great brass bolts surrounded by lead. And so in an earthquake, the lead would liquefy and move, and the whole structure would move and be supple. And engineers from modern Japan had come to study this remarkable thing. What people say is that it was emblematic of the quality that Daesh wants to destroy, the house of gods, the realm of refugees. And as we listen to the swirling news now, the Syrian refugees and the train in Hungary that is stopped now, dark after the sweltering heat, with refugees who were told that the train was going to Germany, and then it stopped in a town in Hungary and said, we will take you to camps now. A Hungarian man said, I'm ashamed to get people on a train telling them it's going somewhere and then stop it and send them to camps. This is not good. We know in Baltimore many things, the protests about Freddie Gray, and one of the signs is the whole damn system is guilty as hell. And we go, yes, but let us be pragmatic mystics and alchemists, again, create an atmosphere whereby the desirable can take place. We know Obama right now is in the Arctic, and we want the spirit of the Arctic to inform Obama's heart as to the drilling in the Arctic. No. Just as the whales of San Ignacio, we've done many shows devoted to them, did for the heart of the president of Mexico when he'd agreed on a deal to destroy the San Ignacio birthing lagoon to a Japanese salt corporation, the fishermen said, well, come out with your family to see the whales before you destroy this thing. And the president went out with his wife and his son, and our great friend and guide who lives there said the whales knew what they had to do. He said they were never so beguiling. They were up and showing their babies and letting themselves be petted by the wife and son of the president of Mexico. And the wife and son were streaming with tears of kinship. And the president said, I can't destroy this. And he changed his mind. So in that way, may we also, as ardent, you know, imaginative doers of good and, you know, going as the whales, the open heart, just as the positive spirit of Persia has prevailed in a sane Iran accord, and feisty gay Democrat from my state of Maryland, Barbara Mikulski, tipped it over the top. So we go, ah, because we are here for compassionate, ingenious response. And so, never mind what minimally passes for conventional public discourse, the sky-earth story within our bones and blood is heartening and is woof-woofing to us. No matter what the tragedies are, it deepens our dedication to contribute goodness. Pragmatic mysticism, vision, manifesting, which becomes a story which inspires people and spirals forth to be manifested and then becomes a story. So David Bloom is one of my favorite humans in this regard of, you know, a vision, long dedication. He joins us because he's been released from jury duty, and so we think of this show as the greater jury duty, the Visionary Activist Show. So we welcome the return of permaculture distillation green wizard David Bloom, mega contributor to rising renaissance of Reverend Engineer and fellow Kahooter at the imminent Symbiosis Festival, symbiosisgathering.com, as Venus right now is returning from the underworld and carrying the mojo of symbiosis, a biological term meaning the union for life of different organisms based on mutual benefit, a living together. Sim is together, bio is living. So David Bloom, researcher, author, farmer, alcohol fuel pioneer, began to work on the puzzle of how to broadly disseminate the means of producing ethanol efficiently and on the smaller scale in the 1970s. Yes, his great book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, is available. His website is full of pragmatic, actually, things happening. Bloom, B-L-U-M-E, bloomdistillation.com. Welcome, David.
Well, I'm so glad to be back on the show, Carolyn.
It is a delight, because you are somebody who's been toiling, working since 1970, and now there's so much on your website that's exciting. It's happening. You're doing it. Wherever you want to dive in, but we've got, you know, there's a movie, and there's Africa, and wherever you want to jump in, we're happy to go.
Well, you know, you and I are going to be at the Symbiosis event in Oakdale in September. And, you know, symbiosis is one of those things where if you watch, you know, the Wildlife Channel or you watch National Geographic, they go, yes, and this tree likes to grow next to this flower, and they have some kind of symbiosis, something together. But, you know, it's symbiosis goes right to the core, to the fabric of living things, and, you know, not just plant to plant, but plants to animals. And, you know, where we end, the next begins is not really a sharp line. And so symbiosis is really a discussion of that gray netherworld in our connection between something and something else. And in ecology, that's all we study, is the connections. You know, we don't study the things. We say, why are these things all in the same place, and, you know, how do they connect to each other? So in permaculture, everything has three things supporting it, three parts of nature supporting it, and it supports three more things just as a beginning. So, you know, when we talk about things that have symbiosis, it really talks about, you know, survival of the fittest, which, by the way, was never said by Charles Darwin. Survival of the fittest was said by Herbert Spence, a right-wing nutcase, Ayn Rand kind of economist, who thought all of us poor people should fight over scarce resources, and only the rich will thrive on the top, and competition, you know, results in plundering and death. And, you know, what Darwin said is, competition is the rare interaction in nature. I mean, sure, there's prey and predators, but that's not competition. Competition where two things fight over the same resource fails, because it means you're not eating and you're not having sex. You know, you're fighting. And so when you do those things, you know, instead of enjoying life and working together, you get rubbed out. Both of you get rubbed out by nature, and they replace you with two cooperating species. So symbiosis is the rule, not the exception.
Beautiful. No, that's great. No, we've been honoring Darwin and how he's been hoodwinked and miscast, because part of also his dynamic is, he said, you know, it's true that predator-prey is a great engine of evolution, and there are manners. There are manners between predator and prey.
Absolutely.
I love Michael Gruber, with his doctorate in predator-prey relations, said that if a prairie dog is close to its den and an eagle or a hawk is overhead, the prairie dog will apparently just wiggle its eyebrows in a secret code going, "Don't bother, buddy, because you'll just waste your energy." And the hawk goes, "Thanks, cat, you know, eat you later." So there's man, but Darwin did say that, you know, the engine of evolution of that kind of dynamic, even with manners that we humans really need back, did not account for altruism, which you're bringing into play. Again, this idea of, you know, bringing this back, you know, that competition is rare in nature and it fails. Great, great theme. But altruism, and so you're one of the great implementers, really, of actual things that are like, well, you know, I love from the recent tour what we took of your incredible, impressive, whatever it is, world headquarters, last spring, you know, that you said that, you know, no waste. You can go to polluting companies and say, you know, you're trying to dump this and regulations and whatnot. I will take your waste. Yeah. I mean, that's such a great vision.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, waste is a word we can't use in permaculture or in any good design, because anything that's a surplus, right, not a waste, but something you didn't figure out a use for, that's sitting there at the end of whatever you've been doing, is really just the input for something else, you know. And so business nowadays is beginning to understand this ecological implication, which there can't be waste anymore. It used to be a deal where you have component A and component B, and you heat them and mix them up, and then you have a product C, and then there's this waste that has to, like, go somewhere. And nowadays, you know, the so-called surplus or waste really makes product D. And then there's something left over from that, which might be left over from product C also. And you mix those two things together, and you get yet not something else. And so, you know, we always look for, you know, what's the use for the surplus. And so when we look at nature, we can look at, for instance, in the Bay Area, which you're very familiar with, somebody a long time ago during the gold rush brought snails from France. Well, snails love it here, and they got out of control. We have surplus snails here in the Bay Area, okay? So someone says, "What can I do with my snail problem?" And I go, "You have a lot of extra snails. You're so lucky." Because what it really means is you have a duck shortage.
Ah.
You see, so ducks will come into your backyard if you put them there, and they will eat the snails. And, you know, what are ducks good for? Well, of course, ducks make eggs, which for those who eat them think they're wonderful. And, you know, ducks, for those who are not vegetarians, can provide food for those folks. And ducks provide great entertainment, you know, and they eat all the bugs in your garden, so you don't have to do any, you know. In other words, all of a sudden, the connection between the slug and the duck become a whole slew of connections that radiate out. And that's how we have to look at how we do our businesses, how we do our relationships, how we do our economy. So we've mentioned refugee camps. Well, yeah. When Haiti had the horrible earthquake, what did people do? They had to cook. So they scattered out from the refugee camp because no one gave them anything to cook with, so they had to find wood. And it was like the termites eating what was left of the forest in Haiti, where people fanned out from the refugee camp to get things to cook with, to burn, to put under pots. And, you know, it was like the scourge of the earth. Now, wait a minute, you know, there were other surpluses there, like a refugee camp has surplus manure, right? I mean, there's half a million people there, and they're pooping, and, wow, if you don't do something with that, if you don't make use of that surplus, it becomes waste or pollution. So, gosh, what if we just put cattail marshes at one end of the camp where the manure was allowed to go into the marsh and, you know, grow cattails, and then we go ahead and harvest the cattails and make them into alcohol and make them into stove, you know, burn that in stoves instead of, you know, the forest, and the alcohol is emission-free and people aren't poisoned by the smoke, and, you know, comes right from the refugee camp, and all of a sudden, you've got a bunch of relationships that take care of themselves versus, you know, put a surplus of people in one spot and have them eat the forest. So, you know, we can do things more intelligently. It isn't required that we continue to do things stupidly.
Right. It's really the symmetry of symbiosis. There was a great short movie on public TV many moons ago about a woman who made puzzles of big things, DNA and galaxies and stuff. And she said, when you wire the human brain, you know, putting there's you know, food, shelter, sex, you know, but putting a puzzle piece in place, you know, stimulated a kind of erotic well-being in the brain. She said, we, you know, just going, oh, that is so beautiful, the symmetry of symbiosis. And that's why I think your work and so many colleagues who are doing great stuff is so important, because people go, oh, that is so beautiful.
And it's so fun.
And it's so fun, and it's elegant. And again, it's the, you know, we are meant to be Venusian artists, put things in place. As you know, one of the things I was most beguiled with at your gigantic permaculture realm was the toad spa. Can we just bring the toad spa into play, because it was so charming?
Well, sure. You know, in a greenhouse, we have 5 acres of greenhouses here at Whiskey Hill Farm, and the whole thing about greenhouses is that it's an artificial environment, which means that if a pest gets in there, it can really take off, because the predators probably are trapped outside, you know, by the glass walls. So, you know, you can have really, really, really extreme surpluses of insects that you don't want in a closed environment like a greenhouse. So the answer is, well, bring in your buddies. And so what we do is we hang a lantern, you know, the old Hotel 6 ad, you know, we'll leave a light on for you. So we leave a light on in the greenhouse, and underneath the light we'll have a pile of rocks, and we'll have a little pond, something about as big as your coffee table. And, well, you know, lights mean different things to different creatures, and to toads, a light means bugs, because bugs go to light. So toads go to light, and so they'll hop over from a mile away if they see a light out in the, you know, out in the countryside. And so they come over to our greenhouse and come in the door and come to the lamp, and they see the pile of rocks, and they go, wow, cool, condominium. Hey, jacuzzi, I'm moving in. So the toads move in, they reproduce, and now there's thousands of toads. And we know from grad students that toads eat 168 bugs a night. I mean, without grad students, we probably wouldn't know anything. But
wait, each toad?
Yes.
Oh.
Each little 2-inch long toad will eat 168 bugs a night.
Oh, buddies. Yeah.
And of course, you look around my greenhouse, you don't see any bug bites on any of the plants. But the other thing about toads is it turns the bugs into fertilizer. And the toads spread the fertilizer by hopping around and pooping wherever they feel like it. And that, each of those poops is a former bug. So it's like, wow, we have bugs. That's great. Because it feeds our toads. But that's only at night. The same pile of rocks houses all of our lizards, and during the day, they're out eating 60 bugs a day. So we have the day crew and the night crew handling all of our potential, you know, surpluses of pest creatures, and we don't have to spend any effort fighting with bugs. Because, you know, if you throw Mother Nature out the window, like trying to spray pesticides or something, she comes back in the door with a pitchfork, and she's pissed. So, you know, the whole thing is we don't have to do any extra work. And extra work in permaculture, we're allergic to that. Not work, but extra work. And so, you know, we get the toads and lizards to do all that, and we can do other things like graft apples, or we can train tomatoes up strings. And, you know, well, they don't do tricks, but they do climb a string. And, you know, we have we can do much more important things than we fight with Mother Nature, which is, you know, a hopeless battle.
And it's more team to say hello to. I mean, we get to come into your greenhouses or wherever we are and go, hello, toads, you know, hello, everybody. And yes, predator, prey, yeah, you're eating the insects, but everybody's getting smarter. That's great. It's very beautiful. It is very beautiful.
And beautiful is the toad song at night.
Oh, yes.
Oh, my God. The toads are so wonderful in the greenhouse at night.
Yeah. No, I love, yes, the night sounds and what are they singing about? Going, bugs taste good. Hello.
Well, what they're singing about, of course, is sex.
Bugs taste good, and I'm cute. I'm a chief. Look at how many bugs I eat. Yes. Well, singing. It's like most songs, human songs. sex and ingenuity and cuteness. But so that's wonderful, and you know, we can go many, many places. But I also, from our last Kahoot, Radio Kahoot, you know, you are so sanguine, meaning kind of we can do this, about the drought in California. You mentioned that your greenhouses that you know have acquired medium recently, but they have not been watered, and there are still roses. And do you want to address just drought for one moment over here?
You know, there's no doubt that there is a shortage of water this year, but when you look at water in nature, you know, and this is what we do out here at our site here in Watsonville, is we help people understand permaculture. And so in permaculture, we always ask, well, what happens to the water that falls on the land? There's a surplus, right, in the winter. And in the summer, we have a shortage. So California has a six-month drought every year from May to November. It just doesn't rain here, almost never. So this is one of the four places in the world that that pattern is true. South Africa is another. It's called a Mediterranean climate. So we're used to drought in California. You don't plant anything if you can't irrigate it. But during the winter, we have a huge surplus of water. And so how do we even things out? Well, in the old days, when there were redwood forests right to the ocean where I am now, well, the forest floor would be covered with all this luscious, spongy, black earth and lots of organic matter, and it wasn't hard and packed and all that. And so when it would rain, the water would sink down deep into the soil, and it would stay there where the trees and other plants would pull it up all year. And we also have fog drip. But here's the thing. What we're about to have, the biggest El Nino in 150 years, we're going to have, they're thinking, three times the normal average rain here in California, and we're going, yippee, and we're getting ready for it. So we're putting these dead level ditches on the property, sometimes called swales, which will intercept the water trying to run off the land and soak in deeply, because mostly water runs off. You're lucky to get 1% of the rainfall actually soaked in deeply if you don't do something to slow it down, keep it from running off the land. So we get 7 million gallons of water falling on our little 14 acres a year. So we're going to go ahead, and we're hurrying, you know, as fast as we can before this deluge happens. And we'll get enough water this year to water trees on the farm for probably 100 years. The water soaked in below 3 or 4 feet will always be available to the trees because it doesn't evaporate. So we can do intelligent things that help us work with our environment and still feed us our wonderful fruit and everything else we want. And maybe we should be smarter about not growing things that need to be so irrigated, like annual grain or something here. So if we work with the patterns that are in our area, suddenly drought is kind of a vague abstract term that doesn't have to do with us, because it's just normal to work with surpluses and shortages and even things out.
Excellent. So may all beings in drought areas, I guess, get ready. You're getting ready with swales. Do you have any advice for the small yard homeowner?
Well, you know, usually the amount of water that someone needs in their house is a lot less than they think they need. My first farm in California was in Redwood City, and I applied for commercial agricultural water rates, even though I was in the suburban area. And they looked at my water bill and they said, well, you don't need any agricultural water rates. You couldn't possibly have a farm there with the small amount of water you're using. And so I said, well, I do have a farm. You have to come look. And so they came up and they saw my several acre farm, you know, on a 30 degree hillside, but I had it all swaled so that every terrace collected its water in the winter, and I didn't need very much water. And they said, my gosh, your several-acre farm here uses less water than our average suburban lawn owner. So, you know, the amount of water you really need is a lot less than you're using if you do the things that nature wants you to do to make the water soak in more deeply. So there would be, you know, there's ways to go about digging deeply. People have, you know, learned from the other wizard, John Jevons, you know, has done wonderful work showing people how to grow a lot of food in a really small space by digging deeply in the soil, loosening things up, getting in air and water. And when it goes in deeply, it doesn't evaporate out, and you can reach that water, you know, over the season with things that are deep rooted. So, you know, there's much more there than we actually think we need. And in fact, in California, we get 87 times as much water as we need if we impounded the water deeply underground with swales or loosening our soil. So we have an amazing abundance of water here. And our forests always did a great job doing that before, but we can help and do it in our own places as well.
No, that's so great. And then just carrying, again, everything in magic backpacks of Visionary Activists show through the years. Eons ago, the economist on the show pointed out that all of our metaphors for money are all water. Currency, cash flow, liquidity, drowning in red ink, rising tide, you know. And so I said, well, all right, money and water as a metaphor. So we want, he said, you know, mostly pipelines suck money and water out of communities with gas station, with alcohol stores and liquor stores and sports stadiums. And he said, so we want to poke holes, and I'm going to throw this back to you in Africa, we want to poke holes in the pipeline so that the money water circulates through the community, you know, and deep, you know, all the things you just said. We want to apply this metaphorically, going swales, swales, and, you know, and the more we slow water down, the faster it infiltrates and supports the community. We're going to take a short break in, you know, 3 minutes or so, but let's start off also in some of the exciting work you're doing in South Africa.
And Richmond.
And Richmond. Okay, thank you. Wherever you want to go. Yeah, do you want to go to Richmond?
Oh, right now?
Sure. Yeah, we'll start it off, and then we'll interrupt for a great song music break, and then we'll come back. But yeah, Richmond, sure, Richmond.
Well, here we are in the Bay Area, right?
Yeah.
Heart of the metropolis, and yet we have a city of 100,000 people with an almost 30% unemployment rate, and sitting literally under the overhang of Chevron here in Richmond. Mm. And, you know, Chevron is the big kahuna and everything. You know, it's an oil town. And yet, Richmond is the largest green city town in the United States, a green party town in the United States. So in the last election, which was disappointing in so many ways, in Richmond, Chevron fielded 5 candidates to go ahead and replace the Green Party mayor and supervisors, and, you know, they spent so much money. They thought they had figured out the ecology of voting to a science, and they bought every billboard for 6 months prior to the election for miles in all directions, and they choked the airwaves with, isn't Chevron wonderful, and, you know, that kind of stuff. And guess what? People didn't buy it. People organized, people got the word out, and all 5 of the Chevron candidates failed, and the Green Party prevailed. So what are we doing in Richmond along with the Green Party? I think everywhere can do what we're going to do. Richmond as a city has said, you guys need to bring alcohol in here because it's not a fossil fuel, and we want to divest. And part of the reason why they're divesting is Chevron blew up a couple of years ago and poisoned 15,000 people. And, well, they were brown people, so, you know, Chevron decided it didn't have to pay anyone anything. And so, you know, needless to say, they're not popular right now. So the idea that we can make alcohol from food processing waste right there in Richmond and then sell those millions of gallons of alcohol in poor neighborhoods for a dollar less than gasoline is really an exciting idea. But it was just what you were talking about a moment ago, Carolyn, because we make the money there. People are paid there to make the fuel, and they spend the money in the local community after they make it, unlike when you buy a gallon of Chevron's brew, where the money goes off to a Swiss bank account somewhere out of your community forever. So that retrenchment of capital by making something locally, buying it locally, it's like, say, Carolyn, you were an alcohol maker there in Maryland. And so, you know, I go to your station, I give you some money for the alcohol, and you take the money, and you need a new door put in your house. And so you go to a local carpenter and give them the money. And the local carpenter, you know, she takes the money and goes to Brad, who's going to give her a massage, you know, for all the work she did on working on your door. She needs a few sore muscles, and so she gives Brad the money. And Brad, on the other hand, you know, he wants to get his car fixed, so he goes to Betsy, and she fixes his car, and he gives the money to her. But some of it leaks out of the system for the parts that were made out of the air, but a lot of it stays because it was hit, you know, her labor. And then she decides she wants to have some organic food, so she goes back to your alcohol plant, where you also have a farm, and you're growing all these wonderful organic vegetables with the byproducts of the alcohol plant, and she gives you money. So the idea is that money just marched around the community, increasing everyone's prosperity, and it was for, in many cases, not just services, but some real goods, like your food, like the alcohol. And that's where this, we step up from an alternative of currency that's only based on labor to one that's based on atoms and labor.
Excellent. Okay, hold that thought. Hold that thought. Our splendid guest is David Blume. You can find out more at Blume, B-L-U-M-E, distillation.com. He's hanging in for the rest of the show. We're going to have a very, very short musical break of something I missed in 1966, 13th Floor Elevator, just because the words are so great. Just here's a smidge. Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. That was just something, thanks to David Boone, Facebook friend, 13th Floor Elevator, a band I missed, apparently, but what great lyrics, just a smidge of that. But I liked it so much. Bedouin tribes ascending. Here we are gathering in many, many forms. My guest, David Blume, and I will be launching the hub stage at the Symbiosis Gathering, symbiosisgathering.com, September 17th. Through the 20th at the Woodward Reservoir, which still has water for swimming and toads in Oakdale, California. And it is it's the hub stage, Friday the 18th. Michaela Gaston and I will, you know, open it up at 11 a.m. and hand the baton to David Blume at 11:30 so we can start off. It's a party with a purpose. It's a celebration of Renaissance so that everybody comes out replenished and smarter, may it be so, and more deeply dedicated to the Renaissance and connected to the world. We gather now because we want to gather woof and support and connections. Everybody's connecting. All of our past, everything we've ever done is connecting with us, and so it is a great time to connect with allies, and hope to see you there. I'll also be doing an Equinox address there, but also an Equinox address at Open Secret in San Rafael on September 22nd, and more about that in ensuing weeks. But now, back to you, David Blume. So yes, again, economy, money, ingenuity, symbiosis, a term that belongs to all of us, the union for life of different organisms on mutual benefit, which is really how nature goes. So yes, all right, we're in Richmond, California, and what a great vision, and what's actually, are you actually installing the distillery there?
We're in the early stages right now, you know, finishing, putting together the details. We have a site that Richmond wants us to set up next to the, right next to a part of the sewage treatment ponds that, you know, are used to evaporate water from surplus nutrients. And we're being invited to grow cattails there, which is an energy crop. And I don't have to get into too much detail about it, but it can be used in sewage and can provide alcohol. But the more important thing about this project is that it's going to make alcohol there, and it's going to make food. And a lot of people hear a lot of blather from the oil companies about, oh, if you use crops for making ethanol, you'll starve African babies. And, of course, corn is used to feed cattle, so you have to wonder if the African babies are eating steak. But, you know, when you get around all that blather, you know, it's really about making more food and alcohol, because like we said earlier, you can make a product and then all the surpluses go to the next thing. So here in our alcohol plant, and the one we'll be doing in Richmond, once we make the alcohol, let's say from a local bakery's, you know, bread waste, because there are bakeries there that are twice as big as my farm, you know, in places like Richmond, and there's a lot of waste dough and two-day-old bread that comes back that has to go somewhere, and that's all starch, you know, and starch is what we make alcohol from. So that waste that otherwise would go to the Richmond landfill can go into our alcohol plant. And so we take, you know, I used to use donuts for making alcohol. Oh, my God, talk about sugar and starch. Donuts are like the mine. So anyway, you make alcohol from this stuff by fermenting it, just like making wine or beer. And then what's left over after you distill out the alcohol is all the nutrients that were in that grain, in the mash, the liquid that's left over in the tank. So now you can use that to make methane. Methane, you know, natural gas, but you make it in a methane digester. And so we have one of those here in California at our test center in Watsonville. So we make the methane, and that provides the energy to run the alcohol plant. So we don't have to use fossil fuel for the heat to run our alcohol plant. But after the methane bugs finish eating up the remains, there's a bunch of nutrients left over, all that nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, all the good stuff plants need. So we go ahead and feed that to our cattails, you know, and that takes all the nutrients out of the water, because surplus nutrients dumped in the bay or wherever would be a pollution. So we can't have surplus nutrients. So we're able to treat our own sewage, so to speak, and then we take it and put it into, let's say, a fish pond where we have spirulina growing, you know, and this is California, right? We all eat spirulina here, you know. But it's an algae kind of thing, and it eats up all the nutrients, and then the fish can eat the spirulina. So now, you know, we're taking the dissolved nutrients and then building them up into something big and solid like an algae, and then fish can eat the algae, and now you've got fish for the poor community that they can afford that's not contaminated with Fukushima radiation or, you know, whatever else is in our, unfortunately, Pacific Ocean. And so now we're bringing protein into the otherwise poor neighborhood that people can afford. And we can even take the fish poop and make shrimp with it. The shrimp love to eat that stuff. So the idea that each thing has a byproduct that makes something else is what's going to happen at our Richmond plant. And Richmond wants to give us a bunch of land in addition to that, because then the liquid that's left over goes into greenhouses. And we would basically be training and certifying people in urban agriculture and selling organic food in the neighborhood in a city that has almost no supermarkets, because like in many poor cities, the supermarkets bail out. Like in Detroit, the whole city of Detroit, there's no supermarkets. You have to go to the suburbs to go shopping. So, you know, we start to bring back the connections in the neighborhood that make Richmond a livable place. And so the city council is like backing us all the way. And, you know, what city council wouldn't want this in their community? This is like, you know, a no-brainer. More jobs, good food, lower cost, clean fuel. I don't know. What else is there to say?
Right. Well, no, it is a great vision, and an implemented vision going right, and Detroit and whatever. But also, yay, Richmond, California. I mean, for all the reasons you say, and then it is also the current headquarters of Nutiva and our ally, John Rulak, who's doing, so Richmond is really having a renaissance. Yeah. I mean, there's ingenious things being applied there. How attractive, under the overhang of Chevron going, okay, composting Chevron. That's very beautiful. And we should remind people what the snippets over the years that I pass on to people, you know, seatmates on planes and whatnot, going, our cars now could run on 50% alcohol without any modification, and with a minor modification could run on alcohol and gasoline if you couldn't find a station, but they can on your website. That's right, basically, right? Right now we can do it.
And it's 98% pollution-free compared to gasoline. In other words, alcohol is a single substance. It burns completely. All that comes out of the tailpipe is carbon dioxide and water. Well, how do you make alcohol? Well, you feed carbon dioxide and water to plants. Plants breathe carbon dioxide, and they drink water, and they make carbohydrates. Carbon dioxide, hydrate, water, you know, kind of makes sense. And what glues it together is sunlight. And so that's what starches and sugars are. We ferment them, make alcohol, put it in a car, and when we burn it, the solar energy explodes in the engine and drives the car down the road and returns the carbon dioxide and water to the next crop to make more fuel. So, you know, that ties a nice loop together, which is very different than oil. So when it comes to the tentacles that people, you know, have, Richmond has decided that the way out of dependence on Chevron for their tax base and everything out is to become a food processing city for the Bay Area, and more organic the better. So they're actually marketing our plant going in at Richmond as a way of attracting food processing businesses, because now you don't have to pay a fortune to get rid of your food processing waste. You just take it over to the Bloom Distillery. And so, you know, here we go into the business ecology of Richmond, and we serve this incredibly valuable function of diverting stuff from the landfill, putting it in, you know, into our system, making food for people and fuel for the cars. I mean, in Richmond, it's not uncommon to go to the gas station and watch people put 80 cents worth of gasoline in their car so they can get to work that day. So, you know, for folks that aren't in the middle class, fuel is a big deal, you know, and it really hurts.
No, let's honor Richmond, come back and do much with that. But also, I do want to go to South Africa, and where you are going, what, frequently, apparently, or?
Well, we recently went there, and some farmers near Cape Town said, you know, we're spending a fortune on electricity. You know, it's $1.50, $2 a kilowatt, and guess what? They shut off the power several hours a day, because South Africa has outstripped its ability to provide electricity for everyone. So here you are running your well pump to irrigate your crop, and bang, they turn off the water for 4 hours. So most businesses have to produce their own energy in some way to operate their business. Now, you know, restaurants, it's very cute. They bring out candles, and everybody has a candlelight dinner when they turn off the power. But you got to get your order in first so they can get it all cooked before the power goes out, right? So people are adapting to the lack of power there, but a lot of places can't. You can't tell everybody, well, go home. They turned off the power, so the factory's closed. So what we're seeing is they're paying 10 times the amount we're paying for electricity, and they can't get enough. So we're having tremendous success in South Africa talking to people about turning food processing waste into alcohol, because South Africa has the same weather as California. And so they have tremendous agricultural output in that country. And, you know, it's what really powers their economy. And so dealing with the waste is a way of dealing with their shortage of energy, not just for cars, because, you know, in South Africa, it's one car for every 15 people. Cars aren't all that important for, you know, the nation of South Africa. But people have to cook their food. And back in the 1600s, Cape Town was forested. And you've been there, Caroline, so you know what I'm talking about, where it looks like, you know, it's pretty much not just deforested, but debushed. You know, I mean, it's really pretty desert looking there. And that's because in the 1600s, they deforested that whole part of Africa because Cape Town was important. People had to cook, and they cut down the trees, they cut down the bushes, they cut down the protea, which is the national flower, to get little twigs to cook. Well, alcohol can be grown from any number of crops that make sense in whatever climate you're in, and you can make the alcohol in great quantities per acre, and people don't have to go out scrounging the woods and cutting down trees to cook their food, which in many parts of Africa, people have to walk five, six, 7 hours one way to get a 100-pound load of wood to carry back to their village to be able to cook for the week. They have to do that again the following week because everywhere closer has already been deforested. And this is a problem all over the world. 3.5 billion people, half the people of the world, cook over three rocks and a wood fire indoors. And you're talking compromising the health to the point of death of 4 million women and children every year. So, you know, it should not compromise your health to cook your food. That just isn't right. So alcohol, you can cook indoors with very simple stoves that we provide. And the project we're doing will probably sell about a third of its alcohol to local people to cook over, because that's a good business, too. It's not like that wood is free or cheap. And a lot of people cook over kerosene indoor when the wood is not available. So and we talked refugee camps. Oh, my God. You know, what are people going to use for cooking? So alcohol for the developing world is probably the most important use of our technology, of our distilleries, is to make fuel for people to cook and not kill themselves cooking over what would otherwise be a renewable fuel, you know, trees. But they cut them down much faster than they can grow back. And that's why people have to walk so far to get wood. So just think about a woman's productive time every week if she doesn't have to do 14 hours of hiking, cutting, and transporting wood back for cooking, and not to mention all the dangers of the road.
Exactly.
So, you know, you know, Carolyn, you know, there's always these stories that come back that slap you in the face. So I was at a conference once, and I had talked to this woman. I knew she was from Monsanto, and I was kind of a little leery of her, you know, because, you know, she's from the corporate great Satan. And in the middle of this thing, she surprised the heck out of me. She stood up in the middle of one of my presentations and said, "You, with your alcohol fuel, can stop the spread of AIDS in Africa." I'm thinking, oh, my God, I have a heckler. This is going to be a wackadoodle thing. And she goes, "No, no, no, listen to me. When a woman goes to get wood all those hours, her chances of being molested are high. And just as bad, if the men go to get the wood, the chances of, you know, an impoverished prostitute needing money, you know, also can spread AIDS. And it comes back to the village. And then, you know, here it is, the ecological problem of deforestation actually causes the spread of human disease." It's like you can't guess about the ecological effect of things, you know, all the time. And here we are looking at deforestation causing the spread of AIDS, and alcohol can stop that by people being able to grow cassava in their village or a little sugar cane, make fuel for everybody. Our stoves for this are actually designed so that when we fill them, you can't get the alcohol out except by burning, which is very important if you want women to adopt alcohol cooking in the home, because they sure don't want the men getting into the alcohol. That's no end of problems. So, you know, the whole thing has been really thought through, and the UN is supporting us in many ways around helping getting alcohol into Africa. And this first plant that we're selling, you know, into the Cape Town area is going to do that.
How exciting. Well, you said, it's on your extremely informative forever website, Blume, B-L-U-M-E, distillation.com, that you had sold the first African-based commercial production biofuel to NumbiTrax, which a company that could be anything. But anyway, so that's a for real thing.
It is, and NumbiTrax is actually a company that teaches or trains anti-poaching rangers. So these are the guys that protect game reserves from the poachers. And, of course, education is rarely a profitable enterprise. So they're instituting their regional alcohol fuel plant with the revenue that will produce will support that nonprofit.
Uh-huh.
And being able to, you know, train rangers for the other reserves in Africa. So it has what I really like is that double whammy. You know, you do it for one thing and actually you get three things out of it. So it'll employ people in the area. It'll help, you know, bring sustainable agriculture into the area, and it will also proliferate rangers that will help protect the wildlife of Africa in that region.
No, that's beautiful. And again, you know, because sim, like symbiotic, means together, and I'm grateful forever to, because loving etymology, Michael Schneider, who said, you know, symbolic means to throw together, and either we have a symbolic relationship to the world or we have a diabolic world.
Oh.
No, it's really important. So symbiotic, symbolic, or diabolic, there, take your pick, cake or death. So that's really crucial. And again, for all of us, I mean, the implications really tease, you know, are teased forth. I mean, the, you know, pretty good news show Vice on HBO did and a really difficult to watch thing on sewage in India, which is like, oh god,
oh yeah,
oh human waste, sewage, like, oh my, whoa, whoa. But again, this is an implication of putting in sewage and getting clean water and getting fuel, you know, again, step by step. And, you know, so is that also part of your expanded partnership vision?
Well, actually, yes. In a matter of days, I'll be going to Los Angeles with the Rocky Mountain Institute, Amory Lovin's organization, you know, another greenie from, you know, way back in the day, our day.
Yes.
And still plowing ahead. So he's invited us to present our technology to 12 mayors of cities in China, because most cities in China have no sewage treatment. And you can imagine that makes for some pretty funky rivers. And, you know, the idea that you could run the city by using the sewage to grow energy crops. I mean, you might not want to use it to grow food crops, right? But you could grow energy crops that would replace the coal that people are burning and make the air more livable, which in China is a big deal, and also clean up the river, you know, rivers, is, and it's incredibly profitable, you know, is very attractive. And we've developed that technology over the years. I, you know, did the biological sewage treatment protocols back in the 80s, and now 500 sewage treatment plants in the United States use them, and we, you know, can get energy crops from that to produce food. In fact, we could provide all the fuel the United States needs by just cultivating energy crops in our poop.
Uh-huh.
Now,
right.
That's poetic, right?
No. I mean, I think it is. We want to head into all that. And as a sidebar, just the vision I like to promote, because years ago nobody's done this yet. But all the abandoned and leaking oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico, you had said years ago, going, well, we could acquire those, you know, donation really, because they're just leaking and abandoned, you know, 10 million each, who knows. But then turn them into, they would be harvesting seaweed, which would pull the heavy metals out of the Gulf and begin to address that ecocide, and then you turn that into alcohol, and it could provide some percentage, you fill that in, of fuel in America, and it would hire all the out-of-work previous oil rig employees. And we go, that's a great vision.
And the fishermen who now, you know, in good conscience can't take oil-polluted shrimp and sell it to the public. But the other thing about that is we could actually replace, if we did marine algae, you know, this is something I've been working on for a long time, marine algae to alcohol in the Gulf. There's 6,500 rigs. If we put a square mile of nets around each rig, we'd have the equivalent of the dead zone in the Gulf from all the surplus nutrients coming down the Mississippi and causing the natural process that gets rid of all the oxygen in the Gulf. So for here we have the nets on the surface that grow almost a foot a day. The algae grows almost a foot a day. So in a week it's, you know, like 7 feet long, and you harvest it off and you can make it into alcohol, because, you know, what's it made of? It's made of sugar. It's a plant. So, you know, and basically long chains of corn sugar is what it's made from. So, you know, if you look on aerial views off of Korea, they have massive, you know, algae farms, you know, where they make all these products, and of course you can also make fuel. Same off of China, you know, we could do the thing in the Gulf. It would clean up the Gulf. It would reoxygenate the Gulf, because plants bubble oxygen into the water and take out CO2, just like land plants. So now you've got massive quantities of sea life, you know, back in the Gulf, where it is a dead zone now for 8,000 square miles every year. And then in the winter, it comes back a little oxygen and things crawl back. And then when all the oxygen goes, they all have to crawl away again. So, you know, we could make huge habitat in the Gulf for everybody, all of our relations. And then after we make the alcohol, you know, underneath each one of those oil rigs is a pipeline that goes to shore. that, you know, they don't take a ship to bring it to shore. Now, we could pump the MASH, which is kelp solution, right up the Midwest, and we could replace all the chemical fertilizer used because we'd have the real stuff. We'd have, I mean, in California, we organic farmers, we use kelp solution and fish emulsion. That's it. That's our fertilizer. So kelp could replace all that phosphorus and stuff that we're running out of that's not renewable, and it's not made from petrochemicals. So we'd be doing a double death blow, you know, to fossil fuel to replace, you know, gasoline in the whole country, but we'd also replace the fertilizer. So, you know, I keep inviting people to take me up on this. We're ready to, you know, fund that project and
yes.
go forward. And, you know, in speaking of funds, you know, that energy is what makes things happen. And we're going to do another conference it's going to be in Boston, November 15th to the 18th. It's the Sustainatopia Conference. And that's kind of a melange of people who bring money to green tech and new green tech ideas. And it's going to be a very exciting conference for those 3 days. And we'll be doing a talk there about food and fuel. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where if people are thinking, you know, I really don't want to leave my money in that Exxon stock, you know, that's in my 401k or whatever, you could find a lot of places to put your money in that conference that would be good for the environment and more profitable. And we'll be there, too, so you get to talk to us. Because our whole effort is actually, you know, when you get down to it, it's how do we do what we're doing? 50 people kicked down some money and made our company go. And that's how we have this incredible test facility that you saw with,
yeah.
you know, fish and algae and cattails and methane and alcohol and all that going on. You know, it's when people decide to support solutions rather than cower in the dark and worry about the disasters.
Right.
And support means, of course, any kind of support. I mean, it's getting on the phone. We had a couple of our stockholders actually spent a week here, like, making alcohol and volunteering at the farm, you know. So, you know, any kind of support
gets you
out of that funk.
There's a million ideas. This is so fabulous again, and you're doing it. You're doing it. We didn't even get to United Airlines and biofuel in the movie. But fortunately, David Blum and I will be cahooting as part of the Symbiosis Festival. I just made sure to skedaddle him in right there so that he's our lead speaker at the Hub Stage on Friday. Michaela Guest and I will be, you know, wolfing it up at 11 a.m., bringing in all the themes and the actual magic we can do at a gathering, and then handing the baton to David. And then I've got the stage, you know, the whole weekend. We can have you back to and fro because you have so much to contribute, and there's just ideas here. It's really great. It's wonderful, and there are many other great people, you know, again, symbiosisgathering.com. But we really want this to be, you know, so that we are training to be more effective players on the team of creation, truly symbiotic. So thank you forever, David Blum. We are in cahoots. I will see you at the Symbiosis Gathering. I will introduce you on the stage at 11:30 on September 18th. I'll also be at Open Secret on September 22nd. And thanks always again, bloomdistillation.com. We will be cahooting more. Really exciting. We didn't even get to just a small fraction of the exciting stuff you're doing. Thanks so much to Douglas Bell in Washington, D.C., Erica Bridgman in Berkeley. I'm Caroline Casey, CoyoteNetworkNews.com. Thanks again, Dave. Woof.
Okay, thank you.
This is Brian Edwards Tekert, very excited to be working on Upfront, weekdays at 7 a.m. with a talented team.
I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Each morning we bring you the latest from the streets of Oakland to the halls of the state capital, from Los Angeles to Afghanistan. We deliver in-depth analysis, hard-hitting interviews, and debates on the issues that affect our lives.
And I'm Eileen Alfandari, working with the KPFA news team to bring you breaking news from across the state, the region, and the world. We'll keep you updated on the latest throughout the morning on KPFA.
It's Upfront, a statewide collaboration that brings you information that matters. That's every weekday morning at 7 a.m. right after Democracy Now! Keep it locked to KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area, KFCF 88.1 FM in the Central Valley, or listen online at kpfa.org. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. See you at 7.
Hey, KPFA listeners. New amendments to the Pacifica radio bylaws have been proposed and are available for review at the Pacifica Foundation website at www.pacifica.org, as well as the upcoming vote by the Pacifica board and delegates regarding these amendments to the Pacifica radio bylaws. That's all at pacifica.org.